Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in London. I'm Tim Franks. It's been another momentous day in Syria. Two big signs of a new order being created, or at least attempts to create a new order. The first came with the announcement of an interim prime minister. The rebel leaders clearly trying to show that they're moving fast to set this upturned and long-ruined country on some sort of stable new footing. The second has been the destruction of Syria's navy, as well as other significant strikes and ground incursions into Syrian territory by the Israeli military. We'll have more on that in about 10 minutes or so. Meanwhile, the United States has set out conditions for giving full recognition to Syria's next government. At a briefing in Washington, the State Department spokesman Matthew Miller outlined the sort of things that the US would want to see before recognizing any transitional government.
The United States fully supports a Syrian-led and Syrian-owned political transition that leads to credible, inclusive, and non-sectarian governance. He has also outlined several principles that we believe should be upheld during the transition process and formation of a new government: respect for the rights of minorities, facilitation of humanitarian assistance, the prevention of Syria from being used as a base for terrorism or posing as a threat to its neighbors, securing and safely destroying any chemical weapons stockpiles.
Well, let's begin our reporting from Syria with our international editor, Jeremy Byrne, who's travelled to Damascus after crossing Syria's border with Lebanon.
Syrians desperate to get home are packing the Lebanese side of the border, waiting for their papers to be inspected so they can cross into a country some have not seen for more than a decade. But on the Syrian side, the crowds are just as big, travelling in the opposite direction, desperate to get out. They are people who don't feel safe under Syria's new rulers, the militia Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, known as HTS, led by Abu Muhammad al-Julani. Families with young children and elderly grandparents sat on the ground with bags of luggage waiting to be allowed into Lebanon, fearing revenge, either because they're from religious sects that supported the former regime or because their men carried guns for Bashar al-Assad.
Talking to a couple of the guys who are trying to get their families out here, there are probably a few thousand people. Now, tell me, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham?
Very bad.
Why? Less, why?
Kill people. Kill women. Kill Muslims, Shia. Kill everybody.
Julani?
Yes. Not Julani.
Hayat Tahrir al-Sham.
The people with Julani.
When we drove into Damascus, it felt calm, quieter than usual, but with shops open, customers queuing for fruit and veg and grilled meat. The fighters of HTS were less visible than they've been. On TV, a little-known politician called Mohammed al-Bashir announced he'd been appointed interim prime minister. Behind him were the green, black and white Syrian flag used by anti-Assad rebels and a white flag with the Islamic Declaration of Faith often used by Sunni Islamist fighters. The new prime minister has been part of the government of Idlib province, which HTS has controlled with Turkish assistance. The head of a prominent Western aid group active in the area told me that the Idlib administration has been increasingly professional and organized. Here in Damascus, there is relief and happiness that Assad has gone, and a willingness to speak openly to foreigners that was unheard of during more than half a century of Assad rule. But everyone here knows that the Middle East is going through a series of geostrategic earthquakes, of which this is the biggest since the Hamas attacks on Israel last year, and the road ahead will be hard.
Well, alongside Jeremy Byrne in Damascus is NewsHour's Lise Doucette. She's been there for two or three days now since the rebels took over in the country. What's the way that she sums up the mood?
Everyone is holding their breath, Tim. Those who, and it is in the majority, who took to the streets to celebrate, who felt they breathed freely for the first time in decades, are trying to hold on to this hope, trying to hold on to this happiness. So one old friend here said to me, "I don't want to say I'm very happy, but I also don't want to say I'm very sad. They are relishing this moment where, to use the old Gramsci, the phrase of the Italian Marxists, the old order is dead and the new one is not yet born. The fact that they feel free here, but they are watching every single move of this new leadership. And it has to be said, Tim, that there are some very worrying signs. Yes, it was very good. We understand that Abu Muhammad al-Jilani, the head of the largest Islamist group, who's now using his own name, Ahmed al-Shara, rather than his nom de guerre, the name of war, that he's working with the old regime of President Bashar al-Assad to avoid the precipitous collapses and calamities, what happened in Iraq and in Libya. But he announced his cabinet, and it is all Islamists. And that is a very dark sign. Syria is one of the most diverse societies across the Middle East, with a multiplicity of Christian sects, of Muslim sects. They all want to feel they have a place. So they're still holding on that something will change. And we have to remember also, Tim, that this is a country of war, the war that started with the peaceful uprising of 2011. It's also been a country under sanctions. You hear it at the hotel where we're staying. I asked the guy for something very simple, a room key. And he said, sorry, we have no more left because we have to get them from China. And I said, it's really hard to get things. He goes, our only friends were China and Russia and Iran. We were the North Korea of the Middle East. Now we want to have better friends. And just looking at him, I just thought, here is a man who has suffered all of his life, and here is a little hope.
Lise Doucette speaking to me from Damascus. The rebels who toppled the Assad regime are offering rewards for information about senior security officers involved in alleged war crimes, and they promised to publish a list of names of people who had tortured political opponents. It's thought that more than 100,000 people disappeared into Syria's network of prisons and detention centres after the protests of 2011 and the years that followed. Some have now been liberated from jail, but the vast majority remain unaccounted for, including Rania al-Abbasi, a dentist in Damascus who was arrested back in 2013. And this is the scarcely credible but utterly awful twist. She was arrested along with her six young children, and they haven't been heard from since. Just before we came on air, I spoke to her sister Naila, who's an obstetrician living in Saudi Arabia. First, why was Rania arrested back in 2013?
The reason for the arrest was just because her husband has been targeted because he has given money to people who was in need from Homs at that time. So he was arrested 2 days before Rania's arrest. Then they came back and they took her along with her six children. Since that time, we try all our best to know where she was, what's happened with her. We were sure that the kids should be released because they are children. The youngest one, she was 1.5 years old.
You've had no information over the past 11
years? No information,
years.
No information at all. They looted all her money, jewelries. She has three cars. You know, she worked in Saudi Arabia for 13 years, Yani. She came back to Syria to start her own work, her own clinic. She was very famous in her
She was
patients.
A dentist, she wasn't
was,
she?
She was a very famous and good surgeon. And she also was the champion, chess champion in Syria for more than 10 consecutive years. You know, she raised the profile of Syria. She participated in Arab and regional championships. And she has the only Syrian lady. She has the international record.
Now that the Assads have fallen and now that the prisons have been opened, take me through what the last few days has been like for you.
I cannot really explain how it was very hard. Yani, this is the day we have been waiting for many, many, many years, the day of the fall of the criminal Bashar al-Assad. This is the day we are looking for since I am a child. You know, if you don't know that also my father was arrested at the time of Hafez al-Assad. Also, he was innocent. He was arrested for 13 years. I was 3 years and a half at that time. I don't know my father. I don't know if he was alive or killed. He was arrested for 13 years. Then he was released because he was sick. And at the time that they think that he was going to die, خلاص, they release him. This happened from 1980 up till 1993. So we are really suffered. We suffered a lot from this regime. So we are really happy, and we should be happy. We should be celebrating now of the fall of regime, but we are not. You know, because this is the day we are waiting to see Rania and her kids. We cannot imagine that they will kill 60 children. Yani, we cannot imagine that. We have hope. We always living with hope that the day will come and we will see Rania and her kids. They were 60 children. You know, I conduct the delivery of two of them, Ala and Ahmad. My mother took care of the children. She was their own mother because, you know, Rania was working. They are very lovely, very lovely. It's very hard to say that we cannot see them again. Yani, the time came and we are waiting beside the television, beside the mobile, beside the all the social media, waiting for any video, chasing all the released prisoner, looking at every face, trying to find anyone to ask. But we cannot find Rania. Where's she? Yani, this is very hard, Yani. At least before we had hope. Now our hope was decreasing, that we cannot find them.
I guess it must be terrifying to think you may not ever know, or that you may end up just having to draw a single terrible conclusion.
Exactly, Annie, exactly. Annie, this is unbelievable. We hear a lot of cases. We hear a lot. We know that the regime has no any human. They are not sparing the children and the women. I know. But it's very hard now to accept that really they was killed. It's very hard. We don't know when and where, and where is at least where they are now, Yani, where they throw them. We don't know anything. But Yani, we are still having little hope. We are still looking, we are still searching, we are still asking. But Yani, we have one way now, because we ask and we know the name of the person who arrested her. We know him. We are trying to find him. He knows the fate of Rania and her kids. For sure he knows, Yani. The only thing we can do for Rania, that the criminal should be face the court. We will chase them.
Naila Alabassi, sister of Rania, aunt of those six young kids. Coming up on the programme, Donald Trump says that the rebels' fight in Syria is nothing to do with the US and his country should stay well away. Now that Assad has gone, will he have to recalculate? We'll hear from his former Assistant Secretary of State for the Near East.
There is no debate that what transpires, the trajectory of Syria, will have enormous impact not only on the United States, but on the stability of the region and our partner and ally, Israel.
More from David Schenker in about 20 minutes. Our headlines this hour: Israel says that it's completely destroyed Syria's navy days after Islamist rebels toppled Bashar al-Assad. More on that in just a moment. And a US congressional report into an assassination attempt on Donald Trump has spoken of a litany of unacceptable security failures. You with NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service. I'm Tim Franks. One of the refrains that already feel familiar about this new changed Syria comes from outside its borders. It's from other governments saying that it's for Syrians themselves to determine the future of their country. And yet one of Syria's neighbours has been very determinedly trying to shape at least one new reality for Syria, and that's Israel, with its series of attacks on Syrian military infrastructure and hardware. Today, the Israeli Defense Minister, Yisrael Katz, announced that the IDF had destroyed Syria's naval fleet. It was, he said, a great success. Mr. Katz also announced that the Israeli military had been ordered to carve out what he called a sterile defense zone in the south of the country.
I hereby warn the rebel leaders in Syria, whoever follows Assad's path will end up like Assad. We will not allow an extremist Islamic terrorist entity to act against Israel across its borders and at the risk of its citizens. We will do whatever is necessary to remove the threat.
Arab nations have declared their outrage. The UN Special Envoy to Syria, Geir Pedersen, said that the strikes and incursions were very troubling. He called on Israel to stop. Amichai Chikli is Israel's Minister for the Diaspora and Combating Anti-Semitism. Does he think there's any risk that these strikes, they may be making tactical sense to Israel, but they might also end up antagonising Syria's new government?
Look, first and for all, what we are doing is preemptive steps to make sure that dangerous weapons do not fall into the hands of the jihadists who are now taking over Syria. We don't know yet who is going to be exactly the governor, who is going to lead Syria. As you know, different parts of the country are held by different organizations and ethnic groups. And I think it's very, very important to understand that organizations like HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, are not moderate, as people trying to say. Yes, these are all warriors that were before in ISIS or Al Qaeda.
And indeed, their leader has insisted that they've changed.
Yeah, I wouldn't rush to believe the statement of Jolani, because when you are following his history and the people that surround him, eventually this is a new version of Al Qaeda, a new version of ISIS. We are seeing the executions of the troops of Assad.
I'm not sure that we've heard any reports. We are all seeing the evidence
on video. You can see what's going on with the Kurds, with other militias related to Erdogan. And therefore, we are not sure who is going exactly to lead. But
I mean, what is
sure
clear,
is
and forgive me for interrupting, is that you've, I mean, quite apart from how the Syrian rebels see you, you've managed to antagonize pretty much the entire region. Some of your people whom you would describe not as, you know, your close friends, but people who have tolerated Israeli behavior have expressed their outrage, and as has the United Nations, especially with these incursions into Syrian territory.
We went to help rescue a UN post on the Syrian border that was actually attacked by the rebels. That's also the reason why we went into the buffer zone of the 1974 lines. You know, the IDF entered the buffer zone. We had an agreement with the previous government of Syria. The previous government does not exist. The lines were crossed by the rebellions, by the jihadists, and therefore we went into new positions within the 1974 borderlines to make sure that we are protected from another incident like October 7 coming now from Syria. By the way, if you will follow statements from the jihadists, they're saying we are going to Jerusalem. If you will follow the statement of Erdogan himself, who is backing these terrorists and arming these terrorists, he's saying that he wants to go into Israel. He said we are going to launch an attack on Israel. That is Erdogan himself, a member in NATO. He said we are going to enter Israel like we did in Libya, etc. So I think we need to be very, very careful. Yes, I think this is good news that the dictatorship of Assad has fallen. I think it's good news. Okay. It is bad for Iran. It is bad for Hezbollah. These are good news.
Amichai Chikli, Israel's Minister for the Diaspora. Shashank Joshi is Defence Editor for The Economist. Israel has made it pretty clear what it is up to in Syria, at least in the short term. What is its long-term strategy?
I think the strategy is destroy as much as they possibly can that would possibly be used by the new government of Syria, because they don't know what that government will be. They don't know whether it will be dominated by HTS, which, of course, as you will have told your listeners repeatedly in the last week, a proscribed terrorist organization in the US, UK and Europe, or elements even more hostile to Israel. But whatever the aim is, it's a remarkable operation. And the IDF estimates that in this 48-hour blitz, they have struck 350 strikes. They've done 350 strikes. They have taken out, they estimate, 70 to 80% of the former regime's strategic military capabilities. This really is a remarkable set of strikes.
Yeah. And I mean, the reason I ask about strategy is that I suppose one of the ways, and clearly, yes, there are calculations to be made by the Israelis and by lots of others about how sort of radically Islamist and possibly aggressively Islamist the new rulers of Syria might be. But equally, I suppose one of the calculations may also be, can HTS and its leader, who is in a sense trying to talk a good talk about rebranding his rebels and trying to bring Syria together, whether he'll be able to make Syria cohere without the infrastructure for a Syrian national army?
Yes, I think their needs have changed, though. The Syrian Arab Army, the Assad regime's forces, needed, in some ways, they were a conventional force. Historically, of course, remember that lots of their weaponry came from the Soviet Union or from Russia, particularly air defense systems, armor and the like. The revolutionaries, the rebels, the Islamist rebels, have a very different set of arms. They're a different type of force. They are considerably less mechanized, less armored. They still have mechanized and armored capabilities, but they're very different. In that sense, they have lots of drones from Turkey. They've presumably received arms from the Turkish government, but also from others. And so they're not preparing in a way, as the Syrian regime did for so many decades, to fight a land war with Israel or to fight a major conventional campaign. And I think Israel has probably avoided striking many of their own weapons. They've focused, I think, on the Assad regime's capabilities. But you're right, overall, this will leave the future government of Syria considerably weaker than it would otherwise have been.
Shashank Joshi from The Economist. Just briefly, we heard earlier in the programme from a woman desperate to hear about her sister and nieces and nephews who'd been disappeared by the Assad regime. We've been getting an update from the Syrian Network for Human Rights. It's been monitoring the fate of detained people. Its director, Fadl Abdulghani, had this to say.
After all the centre detention is opened, this is the time and this is the moment to announce, unfortunately, that the vast majority, I'm talking about between 85 to 90% from the enforced disappearance in Assad center detention have been killed. And we are very much sorry to announce that to the Syrian people.
Fadl Abdulghani speaking to the BBC earlier today. You're listening to NewsHour. The Indian multinational Adani Group, involved in construction and energy projects worldwide, is facing scrutiny following a recent US indictment. The company's also been accused of corruption in Kenya, where it secured contracts worth about $2.5 billion. Adani Group strongly denies the allegations. One of the deals was exposed by a whistleblower called Nelson Amenya, who says he feels he's now unable to return to Kenya, fearing for his safety. The BBC's Esther Kahumbi has been speaking to him. Why did he get involved?
I want to see a better Kenya. I want to see a better country, my home, you know, country becoming developed, industrialized, and an end to corruption. And we all have to play a part. So I was doing it for my country, and it's a big sacrifice. I am not able to go back to Kenya because obviously I have received threats and from credible intelligence agencies and people in Kenya that have warned me not to go back because obviously there are some people who are very angry with what I did and they would like to, you know, come at me.
Kenya cancelled the deal, the energy deal and the airport deal after the indictment in the US. Do you feel vindicated?
I actually feel quite vindicated because I said a lot of times this company has a record of bribery, has a record of money laundering. And also for the president to cancel the deal, then it means it was a bad deal.
You've talked about these red flags. Were they breaking any Kenyan laws?
they never did a due diligence for this company. So in the PPP Act, it says the company should not have any pending legal cases in court in the last 5 years. And also, they did not follow the due process of procurement. By July, when I was exposing this, they had not done any public participation. It was still quite secret, this deal. And at that time, they were just a month from signing the deal.
What evidence do you have that these documents are legit? Did you go through any process of verification to ensure that what you are reading was accurate?
What made the documents authentic to me was they had timestamps, they had stamps of Kenya Airports Authority, and the people who were giving me these documents were from legitimate departments of government.
Yeah. The government has denied any irregularities, corruption or bribery involved in the energy deal or even in JKA. What do you make of their denials?
It's normal. Even Adani denied, and even the indictment in the US, they have also denied. So we don't expect any less or any better.
Nelson Omenia speaking to Esther Kahumbi. Adani Group has dismissed Nelson's claims as baseless and malicious. A spokesperson told the BBC that no airport contracts had been signed and the proposals had been submitted following Kenyan public-private partnership regulations. The company also denies all allegations and insinuations of any violation of Kenyan laws in their operations or proposals. And the company says every project they undertake is governed by a strong commitment to compliance, transparency and the laws of the country in which they operate. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service, with me, Tim Franks. We started the programme in Damascus. We're going to head now further south in Syria to the city of Deraa. It was where, early in the protests against Bashar al-Assad back in 2011, a group of teenage boys were arrested and tortured for putting up anti-government graffiti. The mutilated body of 13-year-old Hamza al-Khatib was later returned to his family, sparking widespread protests, which drew harsh crackdowns from government forces. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson has been to Deraa to meet Hamza's mother and the new military leader there.
While Deraa was celebrating on Sunday, Samira al-Khatib was waiting and hoping. If anyone should be happy at the fall of Bashar al-Assad, it's her. The mutilated body of her 13-year-old son Hamza was returned by Assad's forces in 2011, weeks after his arrest at an anti-government protest. But Samira isn't celebrating. Today she learnt that another son, Omar, arrested in 2019, had also died in custody. Confirmed in files from the notorious Said Naya prison, released on social media by people desperately searching for their relatives. Shaking with grief, Samira called on God to exact revenge on Bashar al-Assad.
Inshallah.
I ask God to afflict him and his children with what afflicted my children, she said. I hope he'll pay the price. This area was a key opposition heartland. Since Sunday, Ahmed al-Alda has been the military leader here, an English literature graduate who became an army officer and then a rebel fighter. He told me he entered Damascus alongside other rebel groups on Sunday, moving embassy staff and civilian government workers to the Four Seasons Hotel and protecting them.
I don't want to punish them because they choose to be with Bashar al-Assad. They are Syrian, but I want to give them a message that we are a human being. We are not animals, as Bashar al-Assad said, that criminal. And I promised them that I will do my best to bring him to the judgment, because we will not forget what he did to the Syrian people, the Syrian children, how he destroyed Syria.
The opposition in this southern part of Syria is different to the alliance led by the Islamist group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which swept down from the north last week. With their common enemy gone, the challenge now is to find a common vision. The war with Assad has ended, but peace in Syria has not yet been won.
Lucy Williamson reporting from Daraa. Donald Trump has been typically emphatic about Syria. His most recent social media post as Syrian rebels closed in on Damascus over the weekend was to proclaim in capitals, the United States should have nothing to do with Syria. This is not our fight. Let it play out. Do not get involved. But recent history has shown that however much the US has tried to pivot away from the Middle East to concentrate its diplomatic and military muscle on other parts of the world, the Middle East has a habit of sucking the US back in. So what clues can we pick up as to the incoming president's approach? David Schenker served as Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs between 2019 and 2021 during President Trump's first term.
Well, I believe the president's inclination is to get out of Syria. In 2018, the president, in fact, ordered the withdrawal of the U.S. deployment. Ultimately, only 200 out of 1,000 soldiers were removed. But I think this would have been an item high on the agenda for Trump if the Assad regime hadn't been toppled. But there is, I think, an important role for the United States to play, not only in terms of humanitarian work, but in helping to shape the transition so that the worst doesn't come about, that we don't end up in a situation like Libya with a prolonged, very damaging civil war, something that is a possibility given the disparate nature of the opposition in the country.
Yeah, and then there's also the question of whether those troops that are U.S. troops who are in northeastern Syria and they're helping direct these frequent strikes that happen against the remnants of the Islamic State group, whether they should be pulled out as the president wanted to do last time. And I think, I mean, I correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that sort of tussle over whether U.S. troops should be pulled out or not led to his then defense secretary resigning.
That is correct. James Mattis did resign the first time that Trump had asked for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. This is a relatively low-cost, high-impact deployment that has kept ISIS at bay. So Trump may, in fact, want to continue with this policy of disengagement, but this would create potentially an enormous vacuum in Syria that no country might fill. There's a real question here as well what our engagements will be with the Turks. President Erdogan had a very influential relationship with President Trump and has backed the Syrian National Army, which is the tip of the spear of the revolution against the Assad regime. And now these troops are apparently moving against the Syrian, the SDF in the east. And there's a concern that our partners are going to be attacked and that what they have established in Rojava and eastern Syria will be dismantled.
Your thinking sounds like the sort of that of the foreign policy establishment, just saying, look, we need to be careful about precipitate moves in Syria because everything is so much in flux. And Mr. Trump is a man who, you know better than me. He has strong gut feelings on things and likes them to be acted upon. And I guess my question is just whether you think there were going to be people around him, people who might just say, hang on a moment, Mr. President, or whether you think that this time round actually he's got people who are more likely to say yes to his initial impulses.
Well, that's the question. Personnel at the end of the day is policy, and the key personnel who are going to be handling the Middle East have yet to be determined.
Well, we know some of the key figures already. I mean, if you think about Tulsi Gabbard, for example, as the Director of National Intelligence, I mean, not with a direct brief on the Middle East, but it will certainly be part of her purview. And I mean, she's got a controversial track record when it comes to Syria. I mean, her visit to Syria, her sit down with Assad, her view when she was a congresswoman that she was skeptical that chemical weapons had been used by Assad. I mean, you know, there are people who have, let's put it this way, unconventional views.
Well, that is everything you've said about Tulsi Gabbard is correct. Certainly unconventional views that differ from not only the intelligence estimate at the time, but the continued estimate. Certainly, I think there is no debate that what transpires, the trajectory of Syria, will have enormous impact not only on the United States, but on the stability of the region and our partner and ally, Israel.
Donald Trump's former Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, David Schenker. We're going to take a brief detour into what I can only hope is a daily look at quantum mechanics. The reason today is what's being touted as a major advance in quantum computing. Comes from Google, who say that their new quantum chip, which they've poetically called Willow, can solve in 5 minutes a problem that would take the world's most powerful supercomputers, at least the currently most powerful supercomputers, 10 septillion years to work out. How impressed should we be? Dr. Stefano Gogioso is a lecturer on quantum computing at Oxford University. He's been explaining all to my colleague Celia Hatton.
Quantum computing is a way of using quantum physics, so the evolution of the smallest state of matter, like photons or electrons, to perform computations that are impossible to perform with our current computing hardware. This is definitely the future of computing. In the next 5, 6, 7 years, we'll start seeing quantum computing unlock applications that are currently impossible in material science and chemistry and optimization.
Okay, so let's focus in on what Google has unveiled. What does the Willow quantum computing chip do?
This is their newest quantum computing chip. It has 105 qubits, so a quantum bit, which sounds little, but every time you add a qubit to a quantum computer, its power increases twofold. So it doubles every time you add one. The computational power of these machines grows exponentially. And by moving from 53 to 105, Google has significantly improved the kind of computation that this machine could in principle do.
Okay, so that sounds pretty impressive. Were you impressed?
There are two things that they announced today. One of them is the results of a standard test, which is known as random circuit sampling. That is what I guess got most of the headlines, because they quoted this 10 septillion years number. That's just a test to measure the capability of their machines. It has no practical applications. It's purely a performance test. The other thing they announced, which didn't get quite as much press because it's more technical, is that they have demonstrated that quantum error correction works, so that quantum computers can scale beyond what we have today. And the bigger we build them, the better they will become. That is a truly momentous achievement. And I think that's the thing we should be focusing on.
How long will it take until we start seeing some practical applications for new developments in quantum computing?
Okay, that's a billion-dollar question. I think the timelines currently are between 5 and 10 years. It could be earlier if we get certain breakthroughs. There are some players that have machines that would scale really fast. If we stick to these current timelines, I think early 2030s is the agreed time when we will start seeing practical applications that are unlocked uniquely by quantum computing.
Okay, and what are the benefits that we might see?
These machines are effectively harnessing physics itself. They are creating simulations that we can tweak. And we can take physical systems that are very hard to simulate because they are complex, because they are quantum, like chemistry. We put them in a quantum computer, and the way the quantum computer evolves, we can tweak it to perform the computation for us. So there are, for example, metal organic frameworks that can be used to do carbon sequestration that could be designed. They are hard to design today because simulating them is impossible on current hardware. You have to make certain approximations that make it hard to understand whether they will work or not once you manufacture them. But with quantum computers, we can get the actual material to behave as closely as possible to how it would in reality. And so it unlocks all kinds of new material science and chemistry and medicine down the line that we couldn't simulate today.
Genuinely fascinating and remarkably clear. Stefano Gogioso, lecturer on quantum computing at Oxford University, explaining everything to Celia Hatton. This is NewsHour. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC with me, Tim Franks. Earlier in the programme, we were talking about Israel's heavy strikes against Syrian military targets. But the Israeli Prime Minister has had other things on his mind today. He's become the first serving Israeli leader to take the witness stand as a criminal defendant. He's facing a series of charges over alleged corruption and fraud, allegations he insists are absurd. The Israeli journalist Noga Tarnopolsky was in the courtroom in Tel Aviv. What kind of figure did the Prime Minister cut?
You know, he almost seemed to be enjoying himself. It was very interesting. He had the opportunity given to him by the judges to make a long prepared statement, which is not usual for a criminal defendant. And he took advantage of it to lecture the panel of three judges and through them all Israelis, basically about the invalidity and lack of legitimacy of Israeli law, of law enforcement, and of the judges themselves and the judiciary. His fundamental claim wasn't, I didn't do what you're accusing me of, because he's been accused of bribery, fraud, and breach of public trust. His fundamental claim was, these laws you're using against me are irrelevant. I'm behaving the way any head of government does. And one of the questions that we're all left with at the end of a very long day is this going to impress the judges, or will it boomerang back against him from sober judges who say, you know, those aren't legal arguments?
Well, you mentioned a very long day. I mean, the whole process has been enormously drawn out. Just take us through a whistle-stop tour of how we've got here and where we might go next.
Netanyahu first began getting into trouble about 8 years ago when some of the people in not his most inner circle, but his secondary circle, his then minister of communications, for example, some of his aides became concerned that he was giving them illegal orders, in particular that he was demanding they change legislation or regulation in improper ways and ways that could benefit his own cronies and in some cases himself. For example, changing regulations governing websites and in exchange getting more positive coverage for himself and for his wife. And those people in his not quite inner circle began to write letters to the civil service commissioner. Those letters eventually triggered a pretty vast investigation by the police. This became public in 2018, and he was indicted on charges of, as we said, fraud, breach of trust, and bribery in 2019. Since then, Netanyahu has waged an unremitting war against law enforcement and the judiciary in Israel, and part of that has been doing everything in his considerable power to delay this day. And it was delayed a very long time, as you just said. And so it was interesting to see that today he kind of seemed to relish the opportunity to kind of, I'd say, to hold forth.
And just in a sentence, Noga, I mean, when might this trial reach its conclusion?
Well, the estimate I got today from Tamar Almog, who's a top legal, legal analyst here, is that this is definitely going to go through at least till 2026.
And that was Noga Tarnopolsky reporting for us out of Tel Aviv. Back in January, Norway became the first country in the world to push ahead with commercial-scale deep-sea mining, the process of removing rock-like nodules packed full of metals from the ocean floor. But just last week, the government in Oslo suspended the plan after a left-wing environmentalist party intervened. On the other side of the world, the tiny Pacific island nation of the Cook Islands is in the third year of a five-year exploration phase to determine the feasibility of deep-sea mining, and they had been looking to Norway as inspiration for mining their waters too. But at what cost? Our Pacific correspondent Katie Watson now reports from the island of Rarotonga.
First ever at sea peaceful demonstration.
We've just boarded a traditional vaka or canoe, and it's a fiberglass catamaran but built in the traditional style.
Kia ora, my name is Alana Matamaru Smith. I am the current director of the Te Epikaere Society, a local non-government environmental organisation based here in the Cook Islands. We want to show, you know, the world that there is actually opposition to deep sea mining here in the Cook Islands, and not everyone is in support or would prefer a significant amount of time being put into this space before any big decisions are made.
Low-lying Pacific Islands are among the nations most vulnerable to climate change. With rising sea levels, the ocean remains their greatest threat, but it's also their greatest provider. They fish in it, they live off tourists drawn to their turquoise waters. Now the Cook Islands wants to dig deeper, to the ocean floor, where there are millions of rocks or nodules packed full of some of the most in-demand resources in the world, cobalt, manganese and nickel, crucial elements in things like electric car batteries and mobile phones.
Hi, Prime Minister, how are you doing?
The Prime Minister, Mark Brown, is leading the Cook Islands' push to mine the ocean. Such is life on a small island, he wears more than one hat. He's the Tourism Minister and the Seabed Minerals Minister too.
They present a huge potential for our country. Countries like us, at the forefront of impacts of climate change, are struggling to find ways to build resilience against the increasing impacts of climate change in our countries.
You think you're finding a way forward that's different, but yet people are saying this is risky, you shouldn't do it.
We know that for the last 20 years we haven't been able to get the financing from the larger emitting countries. So we've got to look to ways to how we can protect ourselves. And our seabed minerals provides an opportunity for us to be able to look at how we can potentially exploit this resource.
The Cook Islands sees deep sea mining as giving this nation some security in an uncertain future. Future income that will give its people better healthcare, education and opportunity. The downside, though, isn't yet clear. Internationally, there's a growing call for a halt on deep sea mining while more research is done. And this island is split.
Wonderful sounds from the island of Rarotonga. That was Katie Watson reporting. You can hear much more of what Katie found about this neuralgic debate over deep sea mining. You can listen to Assignment on BBC World Service or wherever you get your BBC podcasts. But from this edition of NewsHour, from me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company.